This episode of Talk Central is brought to you by Pinnacle, Africa's top ICT distribution business, delivering the exceptional every time.
I'm Richard van der Berg.
And I'm Duncan MacLeod.
This is Talk Central, episode 228 for the week starting 29 July 2018.
Talk Central is brought to you by Tech Central. You can WhatsApp the show on 071-999-1111.
On Talk Central this week, Tap and Go payments as Samsung Pay nears launch, finally.
Also this week, Cell C fires a salver at MTN over WhatsApp, rumors of new Samsung phones, and Apple wants you to charge your phone wirelessly with your MacBook.
Nice. It's Sunday. It's 1 p.m. We're live on live.techcentral.co.za, and it's time to talk everything tech.
Well, welcome to the show. How's it, Richard?
How's it, Duncan?
And welcome to all our live listeners on live.techcentral.co.za. Just a reminder, you can WhatsApp the show, 071-999-1111, and we will take your WhatsApps live on air. It's been quite a busy week. Winter is drawing to a close, finally.
Finally.
It's starting to warm up a bit here in Joburg. And lots of hot news to talk about this week. But before we get into it all, let's do our quiz.
The first question, which bank has said it will allow customers to trial Samsung Pay in South Africa ahead of its commercial launch?
Intel shares fell sharply this week after it delayed the introduction of what?
Third question, the shares of two social media companies took a battering this week over fears about their ability to continue to grow user numbers.
And the fourth question, Altron this week concluded the sale of which legacy business?
And the final question, what exciting discovery was made on Mars this week? And it's a pretty big one.
It's a big one indeed. We'll get to the answers to the questions and the quiz at the end of the show, as always. But, Richard, let's jump into this week's news. And Samsung Pay is coming to South Africa, finally. It's been in the works for a long time. I remember first writing about this, I think it must have been at least 2 years ago. And they initially promised it would be here in the first quarter of 2017. That was delayed until the third quarter of 2017, meant to coincide with the introduction of the Galaxy Note 8. It didn't happen. But Samsung now finally appears to be readying its launch, I presume in time for the launch of the Galaxy Note 9, which is happening next month in New York, which is their second big flagship announcement of the year after the Galaxy S9 and S9 Plus announcement towards the beginning of the year. And, APSA has announced this week that they are going to be offering their clients early access to Samsung Pay on a sort of test basis. My guess is that we're going to see the launch at or soon after the launch of the Note 9, which is happening, I think, on August the 9th in Brooklyn in New York. And it's obviously the second big flagship of the year for Samsung and their phablet format device. Mm-hmm.
With better battery.
Better battery, bigger screen, slightly bigger screen is the rumor. But I think the Note 9 launch this year will be quite iterative. Certainly, if you look at all the leaks that have been coming out, it's not going to be a huge change on previous models. The rumor is that S Pen, though, will have Bluetooth in it, which will give it additional functionality.
Now, it's getting to a point where you have to ask, what are the guys going to bring out next that really differentiates them from the rest of the pack? Mm. I mean, we've kind of hit the peak of what a little brick can do, right, in terms of look and feel and, I mean, even functionality inside. It's got all the gadgets now. I mean, this kind of payment system is a little additional extra, and soon everybody will have it.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about rumored new Samsung phones for 2019 a bit later in the show. But Tap and Go thing is quite interesting. I bank with F&B and I use Tap and Pay wherever I go now, as long as the transaction amount is less than 200 Rand, which I think is still the limit. So I use it all the time. And
it's fantastic to see more and more guys bringing it on.
Yeah, and I think the other banks are supporting it as well. You bank with Nedbank. Do they have Tap and Pay cards? I'm sure they do.
Yeah, and it works with – I mean, Tap and Pay is a standard system, right? So as long as the terminal and the bank, the merchant support that chain, you can use any Tap and Pay with any merchant device. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
it doesn't really matter what the brand it is you're using, as long as it's got that little Wi-Fi looking symbol and that the handheld device supports it.
Yeah. I've been trying. I haven't tried too hard, I must concede, but I did try and set up Tap and Pay with my smartphone, which is a Galaxy S8. To use at the point of sale, and I couldn't get it to work. I haven't spent an enormous amount of time trying to troubleshoot it, but you're supposed to be able to tap and pay with your phone with FNB, and I presume some of the other banks as well, at the point of sale. But I haven't been able to get it to work. But
as opposed to using your card, you mean? As opposed to using your card.
Exactly, yeah. So if you go into settings and you look at payments in Android, on my phone, the app has obviously installed this, but if you go into settings and look under, I think it's under NFC or payments, I forget which.
Yeah, I think it's NFC, yeah.
Under NFC, it's actually got a payments option, and it's set there as F&B Pay. So it should work in theory, but maybe I just need to put a bit more effort into figuring out why it's not working. Maybe I'll chat to my friendly local Bitcoin ATM spa owner one of these days and find out if what the reason is for it. It's super convenient. I always carry my wallet with me, but if I could tap and pay with my phone, then there's a good chance I'd leave my wallet at home.
Oh yeah. I see my option on this Android only gives me Google Pay.
Google Pay, that's interesting. But that's probably because you haven't installed the F&B app on your phone. If you install the F&B app...
But I'm not an F&B client, yeah. But my bank app doesn't
do it.
So it's obviously F&B specific, yeah.
I suppose it'll come to all banks eventually. Maybe as an experiment, I'll go up to my local spa and see if I can get it to work and report back in our next podcast on exactly why it isn't working or hasn't been working up to now. But it's quite exciting, Tap and Go payments. I find it super convenient. I know some people are concerned about the security around it. The question that I've had, though, is why would I want to use Samsung Pay if I can use my bank-specific app to pay? I'd probably trust my bank more than I would a cell phone manufacturer.
Yeah, yeah.
To do payments.
I think it's all the same thing. When Samsung launches this, obviously there's specific hardware that goes with it. I don't think it's exactly the same as what your car does, is it? Is it the same NFC tech?
I don't know. It does use NFC, so I presume it's all very similar, if not the same.
It should be the same. That's why, I've always been wondering why isn't it just standard and make it easy. Maybe it's something that needs to be approved for a cell phone, for an app to do it rather than a card-based, because a card is verified and authenticated by the bank.
That's true.
When you pick it up.
Yeah.
And maybe it just needs some additional authentication between, your app and your phone. And I think a brand like Samsung needs to drive it, similar with Apple and their initiatives in the US around this. Mm. When they launched, they rolled out massive. Now everybody's kind of doing it and got it.
Yeah. I must say, maybe I've got no reason for thinking this way, but I think I'd be more inclined to use my bank's service to do a tap and pay on my mobile phone than to use the mobile phone software.
I guess it all depends on kind of that opportunity. I mean, I use SnapScan still a lot.
I use it
every time over.
Sometimes
when I see it, then can you hear me?
Oh, you disappeared for a moment. But I think that 1 gigabit line of yours is starting to get a bit flaky. But
maybe.
But it's so convenient. There might be security issues. I don't know. I'm not an expert on these things, but I use it all the time and don't worry about it. Particularly because there's a daily limit on it as well. So when you tap, I think the limit is still set at 200 Rand. I think F&B was talking about pushing it up to 500 Rand at some point. I don't know if they've done that yet. Mm. But there's so many of these micropayments where I don't use cash anymore. If I was going to buy the newspaper, for example, in the past I'd haul out some coins out of my wallet and pay at the point of sale, but now I simply tap my card.
I think I actually lost my train of thought there, but I think I also prefer using the card over. I would prefer using it over anything else. Yeah. When it comes to the limit, though, there's obviously, if you go over a limit, you just have to put in your PIN. It just makes the entire process easier. You don't have to hand over your card. That person then needs to put in the numbers, and it just makes the checkout process so much easier.
I think it's safer because there's less chance of skimming.
Yeah. Did you see, though, that that video that was doing the rounds about a guy that was showing how Tap and Pay could be kind of used to steal money out of your wallet, out of your back pocket? So a guy was standing in the back of a shop. This guy was talking to the camera with a terminal. Obviously, they were just showing what can be done.
Yeah.
The guy standing against the wall was looking at a magazine. He had a bulge. He just put 5 cents on the machine, walked up to the guy's pocket and tapped it on, or got close to where the wallet was, yeah. And it scanned and obviously made the process go through. But, I mean, it still made a beep. So, you know, in terms of security, I wouldn't be too worried about that kind of thing, people stealing my money by walking past me with a credit card machine. Although it does raise concerns for the tech going forward. You know, if those readers become smaller, you can just bump into somebody and potentially tap their wallet.
Yeah, I think it is important to keep these limits on the service until all the possibilities are ironed out. Because the last thing you want to do is someone tapping your wallet, and next thing 50,000 rand goes off your account.
Exactly. I mean, we spoke about this a few times in the past. There's a company called Tranwall that's got this technology that allows you to switch that kind of thing on and off with an app on your phone. And I still don't know why none of the banks locally have rolled that out, because that would eliminate all of these issues. You know, you have control over when your card is actually active to allow a payment.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're out about in public, it's off. And when you go into a shop, you just flip the switch in your app. It switches on that, well, it activates a card, or at least tells the bank that, okay, now I'm accepting orders on this card.
Yes.
It just seems logical. I would really love to see it.
Yeah. I'm surprised that more of the banks haven't rolled out that sort of on-off functionality. I wonder why they haven't.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't an app. And if anybody wants to know more about this, just go search on Tech Central for Tranwall. The article was written a few years ago, but I've seen a few updates since, and the tech is sound.
Yeah. So I shall report back in our next episode on my adventures in smartphone tap and pay land. Hopefully I managed to get it right. But
I will enjoy the shopping spree.
I will go and talk to George at my local spa and ask him. He's quite tech savvy, so he's the guy who put the Bitcoin machine in, the Bitcoin ATM.
It's still there.
It's still there, yeah. Nice, I actually saw someone using it the other day.
Cool.
So it's I did put $200 in it the other day, and I was a bit alarmed at the charges that came off. Although I think that was that may have been charges from Luna, as I was transferring into my Luna wallet, because you can set up your Luna wallet to work with the machine.
Oh yeah.
So I'm not sure it was the machine. It was George charging a huge commission, or whether it was Luna. It may have been the latter, but he is quite tech savvy, so I'll ask him for his views. Mm. And
was it a transaction fee or what?
It was a service charge of some kind, yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. So it wasn't actually currency. It wasn't a fluctuation currency.
No, Bitcoin currency.
That was.
No, but it was some. It was an alarmingly large number, like 7% of my deposit or something.
Wow.
Yeah. Bitcoin is doing well. We'll talk a bit about that a bit later in the show. But I'm quite happy with my investments there so far. Let's talk a bit about WhatsApp. You know, this app has become so crucial to communication in South Africa.
Yeah.
It's probably even more so than SMS ever was. And people are hungry for it, and they need access to it. It's a platform not just for social communication, but it's a platform for, I mean, I communicate with people on WhatsApp now instead of email. It's in some ways it's replacing email communication.
It's become an acceptable generic platform for messaging, which is fantastic.
Yeah. And I talked to a lot of people that way. You need to get hold of a CEO to ask him something. Very often he's in a meeting, so send him a quick WhatsApp, and he'll come back to you in a couple of minutes. So it's a useful tool for journalists as well. But for people who are looking for jobs, that sort of thing, it's almost become indispensable to have access to WhatsApp. And if you struggle to pay for data on your phone, if you're sort of constantly switching your mobile data off because you're worried that your smart device is going to consume what meager amount of prepaid data you have, it's a big problem if you're in that if you're in that category. So I think it's quite exciting that the mobile operators are introducing WhatsApp specific bundles to encourage people to come onto their networks. Now, MTN announced about a month ago that they were increasing the price of their WhatsApp bundle, which was I think 1 gigabyte of data on WhatsApp for 10 rand a month, by 200% to 30 rand a month. Now, those don't sound like big numbers to you and me, but I think the difference between 10 rand and 30 rand, for someone who might be, struggling to get 3 meals a day, is a meaningful amount of money. So I think it was unfortunate that they increased those, that the price on that bundle by so much, because it is a lifeline for so many people. But Cell C this week clearly firing a salvo back at MTN and in an attempt to bring across users onto its network, has announced that they're introducing some new WhatsApp bundles, very aggressively priced. So they're offering a 1.2 gigabyte of data WhatsApp bundle, which includes Facebook data.
Sure.
For 17 around a month.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Which is pretty aggressive, right? And they're also offering, I think it's a 49 rand a month, they're offering 4 gigabytes to both of those two services. I'm just having a look here. For 4 rand, Cell C customers get 80 megabytes of data for use with both WhatsApp and Facebook for 24 hours, while 17 rand gets 1.2 gigabytes for 30 days and 49 rand gets 4 gigabytes for 30 days. Those are pretty compelling prices. And if you need to be on WhatsApp, 17 rand for a month's worth of WhatsApp. I mean, on WhatsApp, you may be able to burn through that on Facebook videos, but I don't think you're going to burn through 1.2 gigabytes just using WhatsApp.
No. You can send pictures and stuff, and still those won't be too big. Unless you start sharing those videos. But
large amounts of video, I think, for that to get through that.
But I don't think that's not what's necessarily being done here. I mean, communication is still the primary primary use here. And if I look at just other usages and why this has become so popular is the group aspect. And, I mean, if I look at my local, the street group, you know, keeping everybody informed with what's going on in the neighborhoods and security messages and all those things, I mean, WhatsApp has become indispensable for that. It's the first time in a long while you've been able to communicate with people in such a direct way using groups on an app that everybody kind of just has by default. You know, it's become a generic.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. That's what I wanted to say. Vodacom, I was having a look at their website. You know, they've launched these social ticket bundles, which they're advertising everywhere. And I was curious as to what they offered on those. So I went and had a look at their website. And they provide cheaper access through these bundles to various social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter and various others. But I was interested to note that none of the social tickets include WhatsApp.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, if we look at why MTN pushed up their pricing so much, I mean, that was a huge jump, right? Do you think it could have been data related? Like, okay, well, guys, used too much.
They said the reason they did it was because they weren't expecting the demand that it created, and it was actually putting enormous pressure on the quality of their 3G network. They said the 3G network is under immense strain, and so they had to push up the price. I don't know if that's just an excuse. Maybe they realized that they could charge more for it, and therefore decided to do so in the context of the competition that's out there. But the claim was that the 3G network was under strain. But yeah, it's a huge increase.
It clearly cost them more than what they bargained for, or it cost them more. Either it was just on whether it was a strain on their service, or whether it physically just cost them more in terms of what people were using their data for. That just the return on their investment wasn't enough.
Could be. Who knows? Who really knows? But the official version is that the 3G network was under strain. And they said they're investing another 200 million or 300 million in their 3G network to try and offset some of the impact of the demand for WhatsApp on their network. Which again just shows you how important the service has become. It also shows you how many people are still using the 3G network as opposed to the LTE network. I think millions of South Africans only have 3G devices, 3G smartphones. Yeah. So that network is not going to be switched off anytime soon, I strongly suspect.
For sure.
Yeah.
I'm having a look at the Vodacom, the tickets. So I'm looking at the video ticket here. They've got 100 meg for 1 hour for 5 rand. Now, this is a video specific package, so it doesn't really include social media and stuff. But for 100 megabytes, I mean, you're not going to be able to do much streaming of any nature, video specifically. I mean, the social stuff, 100 megabytes, you can understand. You can still do a lot with it.
Oh, those prices were not cheap. No, they had a 100 megabyte option, which included Netflix.
Yeah, but that's exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah, so even YouTube, even YouTube scaling to 360, maybe you can get a bit more. But I don't understand it. Maybe I don't understand.
It is expensive. It is expensive. But WhatsApp, which I was really intrigued about, what does that tell us? Is Vodacom terrified of WhatsApp eroding its voice and SMS business that they don't include it in the social tickets?
Well, it's already kind of eaten away at that SMS section, right? So now I think maybe that's what MTN also realized. Like, okay, guys, we are maybe losing more on the SMS side.
Good point.
And that's why we have to, maybe we need to compensate. Maybe that was the reason.
Good point, yeah. But Cell C definitely trying to step into the gap there that MTN might have left behind by hiking those prices. And that's the wonderful thing about a competitive market is one operator does one thing, another operator sees an opportunity and jumps in.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if we had a monopoly in the mobile industry, then, you know, consumers would just have to lump it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the fact that there's four operators in the market encourages competition, and so Cell C has reacted to MTN's move and obviously hoping to win over customers. So good stuff, good stuff. But yeah, I was intrigued that Vodacom doesn't include WhatsApp in its social tickets. I mean, it just seems a bit bizarre.
They cover every other aspect of any kind of internet usage you would have for apps, music players, social media. Even video, but that's why the video is so out of place for me. It just doesn't make sense why you would bundle it like that.
On a 100 megabyte bundle, yeah. I mean, there are bigger bundles available, but, you know, I mean, who's going to watch Netflix on a 100 meg bundle?
Yeah. Exactly.
That wouldn't even get you through one 30-minute comedy show on low quality.
Yeah, probably not. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a base option, I guess, to fill in that slot. I don't know.
Yeah. Good. Anyway, we need to take a quick ad break for our podcast listeners. For our live listeners, we'll be back right now.
Are you a search engine? Because you found me.
I feel we have a strong connection.
Well, you're pretty fly for a Wi-Fi. Should we drop it like a hotspot and head back to yours so we can show Max and snuggle? Let's get Giga with it.
But I don't have fiber. Don't get caught in 50 shades of delay. Broadband your horizons and switch to Vox's super fast, super reliable fiber network. Experience the momentum. Connect your world. Visit us at vox.co.za/fiber.
Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Welcome back to the show. How's it, Rehot?
How's it, Duncan?
Good, thanks. So we were talking a little bit about Samsung's upcoming phones a bit earlier in the podcast, and there's some interesting rumors that are starting to circulate about what might be coming early next year from Samsung. Obviously, we're expecting the Galaxy S10 and S10 Plus, but there are rumors, that strong rumors, that Samsung is going to introduce something called the Samsung Galaxy X. Or 10, I'm not sure how you'll pronounce it. If it's Apple-like, it'll be 10, I suppose. And the rumors doing the rounds on various websites and proper tech, US tech websites, not fake news sites, is that is that the Galaxy X is going to be Samsung's first foldable smartphone.
Nice, and I see there's a differentiator from what we know.
Yeah, indeed. That would represent a step forward. But the question is, why? What would you be able to do with a foldable phone that you can't do with a standard smartphone?
I can see a lot of uses for that. I mean, I always complain about my Android being just too big, right? It's or any kind of larger than a 6-inch device. I guess a lot of people like the big size screen, but putting it in your pocket, it's a problem. Not all pockets are made the same, right? So it doesn't always fit everywhere. And I can only imagine with bigger devices, you know, this will allow you to actually have maybe a 10-inch foldable device that becomes a 5-inch in your pocket or something. I mean, could be interesting to see what they can do with it.
Yeah, the rumor is it's going to have a 4K display and that the display size is going to be rather large. I suppose the idea of having a foldable display is that you can turn your smartphone into a miniature tablet. A bigger screen device which you can then watch movies on or consume magazines.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, if you fold it sideways, but I think the real usage here is just storing it and putting it in your pocket, right? I mean, because if I'm looking at the sketches here for how it plans to fold, it's folding inwards like a clamshell.
Yes.
So I don't know. Well, I don't know if that hinge mechanism, which looks like it could go backwards because it's got an XY little angular arrow section underneath it. So it could go fold the other way so you can flip it up and just have one side on.
Yeah.
That could be an interesting use case. And yeah. if you scale this up to a notebook, now you've got that dual screen notebook. All, you know, we have two screens, basically two tablets on each side.
Yeah, I could see a huge impact in the laptop market. If you're, although would you really want to tap on a screen to type? I mean, it's
no, definitely not. No, that's rather, been proven to be
you'd,
terrible.
You'd rather have a proper tactile keyboard, right?
But there's a lot of reasons why you would want that. I mean, still in a flip device, a flip large screen device.
But I could see different models emerging here, like you know the new MacBook Pro has that touch. What do you call it? Touch bar above the keyboard. Bar, yeah. Imagine the screen came down and then curved gently down towards the keyboard. And the screen and the bottom part of the laptop where the keyboard is housed
is one. Yeah. Let's make this puts a different twist on Samsung. What was it called, that screen that they brought out a few years ago that was wrapping around the edges? The Infinity Display or something.
You mean what they introduced with the S7, I think, or the S6?
Yes. Edge to edge.
Yeah.
But that's kind of fallen away now, right? So this, I mean, it kind of showed people kind of did like that and what you can do with that side strip, but this is more practical.
No, the S8 and S9 still have that curve at the edge. You can still tap at the edge of the screen to bring in menus and stuff. But this is, this is a concept that's completely different. And if Samsung can bring this to market, it's certainly going to get people talking. I'm not sure I'd buy generation one of such a technology, though. It sounds like it's something that could break quite easily.
Well, you never know. Maybe that. Yeah, I mean, you'd have to put it through a few stress tests. But I don't think Samsung would put something like this. Well, okay, maybe I shouldn't say that when we've got the battery debacle a few years behind us. But Samsung wouldn't put something out, I think, that wouldn't survive general day-to-day use, especially with a new technology like this, because this could ruin a company like that if they mess it up.
That's true.
It does show what else could be done. I mean, we know a lot of companies develop new tech and they themselves don't quite know what. I mean, Google Glass is one of those examples. You know, it's kind of a precursor to other technologies and other things that they're working with. So by bringing something like this to market, even if it's one or two consumer models, they'll get a lot of data from how people use it. People on YouTube will have interesting videos on how they use their flip screen and how kind of, you know, it's different from using any other phone. I think that could be a good play as well. Because if the technology is there and you can bend a screen, the next thing is to find a use for it.
I think I'd have to see this technology and play with it before I'm convinced that it makes 100% sense. It sounds exciting, and the ability to have a bendable phone sounds awesome, but in all practicality, is it something that consumers really want?
Yeah, maybe. Look, I mean, if I look at my personal use case with my big phone, if I could fold this thing and put it in my pocket when I go cycle, it'll make a lot more sense than having this kind of bulky thing sitting in my pocket, you know, which is not ideal.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing tech, though, if you think about it, about what you'd be doing, bending a screen at that sort of angle. There are lots of videos on YouTube already of Chinese companies that are experimenting with technology. I was watching one the other day of almost a tablet-sized device that folded up into a small book, and you open it up and it became a full screen that you could, like a book, e-book that you could,
like a proper book,
that you could read and flip through. So the technology is getting there. It's probably almost ready for commercial deployment, but how groundbreaking it really is going to be in terms of the consumer experience.
Have you not seen Blade Runner? Have you not seen all those screens and bendy screens in the future? This is where it starts.
I hate to admit it, but I have not seen Blade Runner.
No, you shouldn't say
it's on my to-do list.
Watch the original first, and then you can do the newer remake, obviously.
I believe it's a fantastic movie, but for some reason I've just never watched it. I must rectify that soon, because I believe it's a cult geek classic.
The soundtrack also is pretty epic.
Okay. I believe they're long movies, though, so I'll have to find some time when I've got a large opening. Have you seen the sequel?
Yes, I have. I enjoyed both of them. But the first one, obviously, it's the first one. It was iconic.
Yeah.
You know, everything about it is just special. The way they did it, the story.
Yeah.
That was good.
Yeah. What is it about it that grabs you?
Well, it was shot beautifully, and like I said, the audio is really great. It's that whole idea of androids, right? And kind of this dystopian future, but this future in which we're going to be sharing our lives with them, and what's going to happen? I mean, I actually can't remember the exact plot story.
The movie came out a very long time ago.
A very long time ago. Yeah, yeah.
When was it? 80s, 70s?
No, I think it was maybe the 80s. I'm sure. We need to Google this. I'll give you an update now.
Okay, I will definitely be watching that sometime in the next couple of months, and I'll let you know my thoughts on it, because it's
82. Yeah,
82. Okay, it's one of those cult movies that for some reason I just never saw. I don't know why. I've seen many of the other great cult movies from the 70s and 80s, but somehow.
This is what made it good was the storyline basically is about an android that becomes like a real kind of, you know, they've got this, you can't distinguish them from a real person type of thing.
So not Siri.
Not Siri. Not Siri yet.
One day in the future. I've been having more and more natural language conversations with the Google Assistant, by the way. It's really getting good. I asked it the other day. I was driving down the highway. I didn't even touch my phone. I just said, actually, I better not say it here because my phone is next to me. I said the wake command for Android for the assistant, and then I said, play this band in Spotify, and it did it, no problem. And I didn't have to touch my phone once.
That's actually a cool use for it.
Yeah.
Because I've been struggling, like, how would I use it? Apart from, you know, I wouldn't really find a use for it. I guess maybe I just need to start doing it and seeing if it works for me, but talking out the things that I need. It makes a lot of sense to be able to just say something and then it happens. I used to use the reminder function, like also activation word, and then please remind me tomorrow to phone, or please schedule this meeting tomorrow.
Oh, use it for that all the time. Remind me at 1 p.m. to do this, for example.
Yeah. I actually need to get back into that habit.
Yeah, I use it all the time, and I check financial information when I'm driving, often between meetings, and I like to keep a close eye on tech stocks and other stocks. I like to keep an eye on Bitcoin, and so I just say the activate word, and then I say I say Bitcoin price in dollars, or I say NASPAS share price, and it'll read it to me, and I don't touch my phone once while I'm driving.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it makes a lot of sense for the way we're starting to use technology to be able to just say it out. In a home environment with a lot of people, or in an office environment, obviously it's a different thing.
Yes.
But I can also see in a home environment where you say, you know, again, tell us the fact about this thing we were just talking about,
and then,
as opposed to people just fiddling on their phone trying to find the answer.
Yeah, no, it is useful. And that Spotify thing is particularly useful. I mean, just say to it something like, play Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon on Spotify, and it'll do it.
See, now that would have been a good one to shout out, so everybody would start playing that immediately.
Absolutely. I was thinking about Dark Side of the Moon, actually, after watching the lunar eclipse on Friday night. Did you have a look at it?
Yeah, I did. I didn't watch the I forget what the word is. I didn't watch the end of it where it goes out of the
yeah, it was quite late.
Out of the show, yeah. But it was beautiful, absolutely. I mean, the whole run-up to it. And there's been some great photographs online, too, just from all over the world.
Yeah, there's some fantastic local photographs. Did you see the one, the time-lapse one over Santon?
I didn't see a time. I saw a photo. You mean the still photograph with the time-lapse of the...
Yeah, I saw that 30 minutes or so.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Stunning. The Santon in the background. And I saw someone in Durban did a fantastic one over the harbour. I'll share it with you after the show.
Cool. Yeah, I'll stop trying to take photographs of stuff like this because I don't have the right equipment, and everybody else's is so much better.
Well, I've been messing around with photography and was trying to take pictures of the moon, and messed it up completely. So I've been doing some further research there, and that's my pick this week. So we'll get to it a little bit later in the podcast. We've got one more news story we need to talk about, and this one is actually quite very interesting. Apple talking about, or has patented, I believe. Is that right, Rehat? Patented?
Patented.
Technology that will allow you to charge your Apple Watch with your iPhone and charge your iPhone with your MacBook, etc. What exactly are they doing?
Yeah, so they basically want to patent the idea that every one of your devices will be able to charge everything else. So you can literally
wirelessly.
So you can literally put your watch on your phone, or your phone on your computer, or your phone on your tablet. And then it will charge. I mean, it's one of those patent filings that you can see. Yeah, they're doing it because it's a pretty good idea. we know where this wireless technology is going, this wireless charging technology is going. I mean, it's not inconceivable to think in a few years every phone will charge this way and you probably would never have to plug it in. Imagine how great that would be. So battery life, it wouldn't really be so much about the actual battery life because it'll be charging the whole time.
Yeah.
So yeah, this patent filing basically shows that they want to that it doesn't show kind of the insight on what they're planning to do with the technology, but it shows that they want to be able to place a device and they've basically patented three or four spots on each device. So they've covered the whole thing. So you can put it on the top, at the bottom, on the back if you want.
Yes.
It's going to be, yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, it makes so much sense, right? I mean, I've often put my phone just next to my computer. Now, if you close the lid of your computer, just pop your phone on top, it should be able to charge it.
Yeah, it makes absolute sense. And I do wonder what impact it would have on weight. Obviously, when you're carrying a laptop around, you want it to be as light as possible. I'd imagine these little wireless charging coils are probably quite light.
Yeah, I mean, the Apple Watch has got it, right? So, I mean, it's very small. It's like a little antenna that just coils up in the back, in the base of the unit or something. So it wouldn't be very thick. And it will sit so close to the device because it's not going to be charging over a centimeter or two. It's going to be within millimeters from its conductive coil. So it's short range, I don't know what the power is, but I would assume low power charging.
Yeah, I've been using wireless charging with my S8 for a long time, and it works incredibly well. I just pop it in the dock on my desk, and my phone is always charged.
I mean, there's tech out there in labs that allows you to charge these devices without being close to, you know, the old Tesla, the Tesla concept where you can send electricity wirelessly anywhere, over distances, and you know, that's been proven to work, which is even more exciting if you think about it. Imagine having a little unit in your room or in your house that just kind of sends a laser beam or whatever it is to each device and just charges everything wherever it is.
I'm going to come to Rechard's house in a few months and I'll just find a burnt crisp on the floor, the remains of Rechard as he was experimenting with all this wireless charging technology.
Yeah, like a little burnt match in the corner with all these devices around me. At least every one of them will be charged.
He died having fun. Well, I look forward to that. Any indication on when Apple might be bringing this to market?
No, I mean, if they've only filed the patent now, I wouldn't imagine it'd be out for maybe another season or two. So maybe I would imagine maybe next year, 2019.
So we probably won't see it in the iPhone this year.
Well, you never know. I mean, you never know. Maybe they were far ahead with the technology already.
Yeah, maybe. But exciting stuff, and I expect other manufacturers are going to do the same. At the moment, Apple introduces it in its laptops. You'll be sure all the Windows manufacturers do the same, especially on their high-end models. But it's quite cool, quite exciting idea.
Oh, very.
Just looking at our WhatsApp line here, we've got a few messages coming in. Mohammed asks, do we have our podcasts on SoundCloud? I'm afraid we don't have them on SoundCloud, but we should add them. So I will do so. Look out for our podcasts on SoundCloud.
Nice.
Sooner rather than later. And then we've got a message from, who's this from? Johan Slubbert, who says, unbreakable plastic screens also coming to Samsung in future. Plastic more bendable.
And probably more affordable too. That's actually quite awesome.
Interesting. He sent a link here as well. I'm not going to click through now, but he sent a link to the Sam Mobile website in which the headline seems to be Samsung's unbreakable display versus Gorilla Glass 6. I'll have a read of that after the show. Certainly there's some interesting innovation coming in display technology over the next couple of years. That takes care of our news this week. Let's move on to our regular features. Our winner this week is Bitcoin, which has been surging lately after dipping below $6,000. I think it fell to about $5,700, $5,800 at one point, and I was getting a bit nervous as a new Bitcoin investor, but it has surged in just the last week or two, mainly in the last week, I think, and is now trading around the $8,200 level. And technical analysts who look at this thing are suggesting that the bull run might be back. The bad times for Bitcoin, which it really has come off very badly in the first half of this year, from peaking at almost $20,000 in December last year. It fell by about 70% during the course of the first 6 months of this year, and people were starting to wonder whether this thing is ever going to go up. But back up it seems to be going, and technical analysts seem to suggest that it's adopted a more bullish trend and could be targeting the $95, $9,600 level in the short term. So as an investor in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, I'm following this with a great deal of interest. If it goes back up to $2,000, $20,000 rather, I will be a very happy person.
So your 5 Bitcoin should be doing quite well then, eh?
I wish I had 5 Bitcoin. I have a fraction of a Bitcoin, but I've also invested in a range of other cryptocurrencies through Bitfund, who I think we spoke about in a previous episode. So I've also invested now in Ethereum and Stellar, IOTA. I forget all the names, but it's my biggest exposure is to Bitcoin, but I'm investing in the 10 biggest cryptos by market value. Which makes it more exciting.
Oh yeah. Just spread your bets.
Yeah. Although they all tend to move together. They don't always. So sometimes you'll have one coin that suddenly jumps and the rest of them don't. But yeah, through the fund I'm with Bitfund, about 58% of my portfolio is Bitcoin.
Yeah, I would also back Bitcoin. I mean, it seems like, you know, it is definitely the big daddy, the granddaddy of them all.
Yeah. Something else may emerge down the line, which is why I was kind of keen on this Bitfund model. You know, they, you know, if you're exposed to these other ones and they rebalance them every week or every fortnight, based on the market value. So, if one of these things starts to outpace one of the others, your exposure to it grows as well, which I think is a clever idea. And our winner, our loser this week is one Facebook CEO by the name of Mark Zuckerberg. He lost $15 billion in one trading session this week after Facebook put out financial results that disappointed investors, particularly the forward-looking statements made by their chief financial officer regarding likely user growth and slowdown in user growth on the Facebook platform. So the share price took an absolute walloping. I think it fell by something like 19 or 20% in one trading session this week. And that, that knocked $15 billion off Mark Zuckerberg's wealth in a single trading session. But don't cry for him. He's still a very, 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 very rich man. I think he's the fourth or fifth richest in the world still, even after this massive knock that he took this week. A bad week at the office for Mark Zuckerberg, without a doubt.
It also just shows you all these social networks that we love so much. I mean, they really are about the bottom dollar. I mean, if you look at a company like Facebook, they've got almost every person on earth. And when they just basically say, oh, we're just struggling to get the last few hundred people on planet Earth, investors say, no, that's not good enough. You're going to be penalized.
Yeah, they've got, I think their latest monthly active users sitting at something like 2.3 billion people, which is, I think that's over a third of the planet, if my maths is correct. Maybe around about a third of the planet.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
And it's something like 60 or 70% of all people who are online are on Facebook.
Look, it's a fantastic service. I still use it daily because it adds a lot of value to what I need to do and just staying connected with people.
Yeah, for sure.
And there's a surprising amount of money to be made on Facebook. It's absolutely ridiculous. I'm not there yet, but there is a lot of money to be made on Facebook. Whether you're doing marketing for it or creating content for it, it's, you know, there's a lot of opportunity there.
How do you make money through Facebook? Through advertising in videos or?
You can get a lot of reach, So any small business can really reach the exact target audience. Most businesses, you know, have customers that are Facebook users. I mean, there's very few companies you can say, probably Facebook wouldn't work for them. Especially in the retail side, you know, when you're buying and selling stuff.
Oh, I see. You mean using Facebook as an advertising platform to drive revenue?
Well, using it as, but also, you know, on the other side of it, just being a voice on there. If you start getting a lot of, it's a good exposure tool. That's probably the best word.
Yeah.
Because everybody, you can reach everybody with it, and it's great exposure.
I'm still using all these social networks, and I do look at them every day, but I'm posting a lot less than I used to. I still have TweetDeck open on a dedicated monitor here in the office, and I watch Twitter. Not all day, but I watch it a good chunk of the day. And but I don't post as much as I used to. And on Facebook, I find myself posting very little. I'm still consuming, seeing what other people are doing, but I'm not posting so much myself. I'm not sure the reason for that. Maybe I'm just getting older and I don't want to share my private stuff with people.
Well, that is it. I mean, there's a lot of things you don't want to share unless you want to be part of a voice. So in my case, for example, there's often things that I want to share, whether it's a story or whether it's a photo, I just want to put it out into the world, whether I want to share it with friends or from a business point of view, share this important piece of information. It doesn't happen often, but when I do post something, you know, I try and make it something, you know, that's adding to a good storyline already, or to a good timeline already, rather than being like so many of these people posting to social media, just an absolute waste of time.
Yeah.
Although Twitter is still very good. I love Twitter.
Yeah, that's my favorite platform as well. It's just the quality of, generally, if you're following the right people, the quality of conversation on there is generally quite good.
It's always been about the people. That's why it's good, because if you follow quality contributors, that's what you said.
Yeah. I always do wonder about people who complain that Twitter has become a cesspool, and how can you even go in there? It's just people sniping at each other, et cetera, et cetera. And, you kind of scratch your head and say, well, why are you following them?
Yeah, why are you contributing?
Unfollow them. Follow people who don't do that.
And using something like TweetDeck, you can easily hide things that you... So if you don't want to... I mean, if people tweet at you, you can very easily not be bothered by that.
Yeah, I use the mute function all the time. I don't like to ban people or block them, but if I see things that are that are bugging me, getting in my way, I just tend to mute people, which I find quite powerful.
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't want to unfollow someone because you might hurt their feelings, so I just mute them.
Well, this is a new worst trend in social media. Like, you see this often. You get followed by people, and then what they expect you to do is you follow them back, and then they unfollow you. So they build their followers.
Yeah. Well, they mute you.
It happens all the time, yeah. It doesn't, but they unfollow you without a doubt. So I often find guys follow and then unfollow within a few days.
Yeah. That's why on Twitter, when you look at someone's profile and you can see they've got a hell of a lot of followers and they're following a lot of people and they've got a lot of followers, it's probably not genuine.
I mean, I try and cut every now and then, just kind of things that businesses that I don't want to follow anymore, people that I don't want to listen to them anymore, whatever. Mm. But you can do it quite successfully with maybe 1,000 people or 2,000, but 400,000 people, there's no ways you can effectively have a good Twitter experience.
No ways, not at all. I suppose you could create lists and just follow those lists, but following that many, I find following more than about 450 people on Twitter is, you just can't keep up. And I regularly go through my followers list and cull people. Once a year or so, I just look at who I'm following, and if I don't find them interesting, I have no qualms about unfollowing them.
Yeah, exactly. No, you have to do that.
If they're a friend of mine, obviously I won't do that. But if I'll go through the list and I haven't seen this person tweet in ages, unfollow. Well, say they've been tweeting rubbish, then I just unfollow them.
Mm.
You have to do it.
Well, it happens. Yeah, but it happens often. I mean, you like or you follow somebody because you like a line of things that have happened. Mm. And after a while, it just becomes less relevant to you and, you just change it up. Nobody should take offense to that. I mean, that's just silly.
Yeah. Although I noticed some people on Twitter have services installed that will alert them when someone unfollows them. So occasionally I get a message saying, hey, I feel hurt because you've unfollowed me.
Oh, no.
It's happened a couple of times.
Well, make your Twitter timeline interesting. I mean, if I don't want to read Heyskunet magazine, I wouldn't subscribe to it.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same thing.
People are funny sometimes. Eh? let's move on to our picks of the week. What have you got this week, Rahad?
So I've been let me backdate the story. My first encounter with Fujifilm digital cameras was when I was working in a camera shop in the 90s, and Fujifilm just launched. They were one of the first guys to bring out digital cameras, and those things were absolutely incredible. They were little square-like cameras, and they were just the first digital cameras that really worked well, in my opinion, and I loved using them. Moved 20 years on, and now it's the first time I've played with a Fujifilm camera since then, and this is the X-H1 mirrorless camera. So it looks like a DSLR, like the big cameras we all know and love, but it's a little bit thinner, quite a bit smaller, and it's mirrorless, which essentially means there's no prism on the inside that bounces the light that's coming through the lens. It's going straight onto the sensor. So it's a full digital camera in a digital era. It gives it quite a lot of benefits, obviously, in what you can do, how you can take photographs, the quality of them. It's a great all-round camera. Now, this is a high-end device. The body goes for around 30,000 Rand, so it's not an entry-level camera. But I was using it for video this week, and I was absolutely blown away by the quality. Now, it can shoot 4K. It's got all the high-resolution specs that you imagine, 24-megapixel photographs. It can do up to 14 frames a second, 4K wow. movie shooting, and it's got some really nice motion features.
14 frames. The lens still photos at 14 frames per second.
Yeah, 14 frames per
That's
second.
That's fast. Photographs. That's very fast.
And it can do decent slow-mo, not at 4K. Obviously, if you drop it down to 1080, you can get the nice slow-mo at about 60 frames, 60 or 80. I stand to be corrected. I don't know if that's
usually 60.
In front of me now.
It's usually 60.
Yeah, it's usually 60. Overall, I really like this camera. I'm still in two minds whether I would switch away from a DSLR. I don't know why. Maybe I need to play with this more just to kind of, because it does work a little bit differently to a camera that you are used to.
Just explain the difference between a DSLR and a mirrorless camera and why I would consider one over another.
Okay, so like I said, the mirrorless, so a traditional DSLR camera or traditional camera like we've seen for the last 100 years, with a camera with a lens that snaps on. The lens, the light comes through the lens, there's a, and then it hits a mirror at the back. It used to be a prism in the old film cameras, but it hits a mirror at the back that then flips up to hit your film or hit your sensor behind the mirror. So that is your, that's the sound you hear. That's when the mirror flips up, and that's how the sound, the light gets through to your sensor. With a mirrorless camera, you don't have that. So you're basically your light goes straight onto the sensor. Now there's a lot of reasons why that is good and why that is bad. I mean, it's just a new technology, that's eliminating a mechanical feature in a body. So there's obviously wear and tear issues that is, has got a lot of benefit to why you would want to go mirrorless. But in today's day and age, it really is about the technology and moving into something that's, I mean, you can't really, if you compare photographs taken with a DSLR and compare photographs taken with mirrorless, you're not going to be able to tell the difference. It's not going to give you a different, unless the camera's got specific features that, you know, obviously allows it to do something cool with that photograph. Like this Fujifilm has got specific film. So because it's Fujifilm, it's got the heritage in 35mm cameras, they've got film profile so that, you know, that gets applied to certain photographs. So you can say if you want a specific film look, and they are pretty cool, I must say. So in terms of technology, DSLRs is just an old technology when you compare it to mirrorless, which eliminates that moving part. And you've got a lot of benefits with it in terms of specifications and what, especially with video, there's it just is much better for video because you don't have a moving shutter that has to go up the whole time, you know, that could fail after hours and hours and hours of usage. Not that it happens often, but it's still a mechanical part in a digital world.
So does mirrorless eventually replace DSLR, or will they both coexist?
Depends on, I guess it's, it depends on what the consumer says, right? If there's still going to be a demand for DSLR, which there definitely is, I don't think it'll go away soon.
Yeah.
But like with any new technology, you know, a lot more brands are bringing out mirrorless. There's like another big benefit of this is stabilization. So this Fujifilm, for example, has got, I think it's like a five axis in-body stabilization. So that sensor physically balances itself out in comparison to the movement that you're doing, if that makes sense. So that really, so I can walk around this with this camera and shoot for video, and it'll be, I'm not saying it'll be stabilized like you would get with like a DJI gimbal, but it will be really good. So for those kind of purposes, a lot of video guys are using mirrorless because it's just so much better for so many more video applications. It's just better purpose built for video applications. But really, you have to go out and check and see if you like that kind of thing. That, you know, I still like that sound and the feel of the shutter. It's a bit of an old school thing, I guess.
I presume mirrorless are lighter as well.
Yeah, look, not really lighter because you've got the lens is still a big part of the weight. That's the glass, really. If you just weigh the body, it could be a little bit lighter. But it's not really it's thinner, definitely. So if you compare it, if I put this next to any other camera, this is much thinner because it doesn't have to have that mirror in there to bounce the light up to your viewfinder.
Okay, interesting. I'm interested in this whole subject because I've just recently bought a new camera, a DSLR, and I didn't even consider mirrorless as an option because I didn't even think of it. But you know, I had a DSLR before, so I thought, no, I'll get another DSLR. I'm very happy with the thing. It's fantastic. But before I made the purchase, I didn't even think mirrorless is an option. And maybe I should have.
Yeah, look, it's interesting to explore, and I think I'll definitely arrange one for you to play with. Like I said, you know, there's no right and wrong here. It's like what you want to play with and what you want to use it for.
Yeah.
DSLR is still a lot of fun because it's just built on this. The technology's been around for so long. I mean, that process, the DSLR, the single lens reflex angle to it. So as long as you're happy shooting, that's even your cell phone would be good enough, right?
Yeah.
But this Fujifilm X-H1, it's about 30,000 rand for the body only. The lens that I've got is a 16-55. I don't have the price for that on me, but Fujinon lenses, and they are absolutely spectacular. I've got some videos that I shot with it, and I'll share it over on social media.
So Fujifilm has its own custom mount, does it?
Yes, no, all of these guys do.
Oh, God.
So you're not going to be able to. Yeah. You can get adapters and stuff, but I wouldn't go there.
Yeah, no, I'm very much stuck in the Nikon world because I have a bunch of Nikon lenses, so whenever I get a new DSLR, it's, okay, which Nikon am I getting next?
And that's how they get you. That's how Apple gets you, too.
I see there was a bit of controversy, actually, just over the last week or two. Nikon announced a new high-end mirrorless camera, and they announced that they would be using a different mount, not the standard F mount that most Nikon cameras use, and the Nikon community was outraged.
I can imagine. Look, I can also understand at some point, depending on what the reason is behind, but you do need to make a tech change if it betters the product, right? So if there is a new mount required, but the F mount's been around since. I mean, you can still buy one of their first cameras, an old manual film camera, and put a new lens on it, and vice versa.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
So you have a bonus pick this week as well.
Yes, I do. And what was it again? Why did I forget my bonus pick?
Lego.
Sorry. The Lego store opening. How did I forget that? And I was playing with a little figurine in my hand here. So South Africa's first official Lego certified store has opened, opening Sandton City. Obviously, where else do you go if you're a premium toy brand? But now that apparently Lego South Africa has been around for a while, but now that they've got now official, a store presence with licensed products. And what this means for Lego fans is that there'll be lots of exclusives, lots of first stuff that'll come there before anybody else. And they will have, you know, just a lot of fun things to do. Like one of my favorite things at the launch of the show, it was on Thursday, was the minifigure stand. So, you know, the little Lego minifigure that's taken on a life of its own.
No, I don't. I know nothing about Lego.
You know nothing about it?
Nothing at all.
Okay, so let me educate you. Lego, you know, Legos are building blocks, but the minifigure that they're bundled with it, you see these things on the side of the box. It's just a little figurine, yellow head, various body types. I actually had an interview with Rob, the one of the co-owners for the Yellow Brick Company, the company behind this new store, and that podcast will be up later this week. And he actually said that there are more minifigures in the world than there are people. And that's an official stat, apparently.
Good grief.
My favorite thing about this shop is the minifigure stand. So you can go in there. They've got all the parts in this nice little box, and you just basically go around, pick a head, pick a body, pick a torso, pick accessories, and you can build three of them for 99 rand. I mean, it is as a Lego fan, that is really cool. And I've got probably about 20 or 30 figures myself, and you know, you just kind of collect them over the years. And it's nice to have a place to go to do that. If you're a Lego fan, definitely worth checking out. They've got the entire range. They don't have all the sets, but they seem to be quite keen on dealing with fans and talking to fans. If people want stuff, if people want to get hold of things, you know, just go talk to them. They seem to be wanting to get involved.
So knowing nothing about Lego, if you're a South African Lego fan and you wanted to buy Lego previously, where would you get it from? Did you have to go to a regular toy store? And
you can get it very easy in South Africa. It's not like there's a shortage by any means. A lot of shops sell them. It's already got a very good user base. I actually, you know, once these stores start rolling out more, I'm sure some of these stores might suffer a bit, because why would you want to go anywhere else if you can go to the official store, right?
Yes.
They seem to be quite competitive with their pricing. I haven't compared it kind of shop by shop. I actually should go and look at that. But they seem to be quite competitively priced. But I think it's again, one of those things where would you want to buy your Lego from? Just a random toy store, unless you know the toy store, or do you want to go to the source and just kind of get it from the geeks that made it. Lego's pretty easy available. Look, the benefit of obviously the shop is, like I said, you know, you get a few extra exclusive, which is always great. So with launch, they've got the new Bugatti Veyron, which is an absolutely beautiful Lego Technique And this thing costs about 6,500 rand. And as a Lego fan, I can totally try and justify that. Should I have that spend free?
Yeah. I'd rather have the original Veyron.
Yeah, but that won't be 6,500 rand, I can assure you. Their Star Wars sets are obviously the most popular. It's been the most popular. It's one of the sets that's actually saved. It's a franchise that saved Lego from almost near bankruptcy.
Interesting.
Because it's just taken on. I mean, there's an entire story. There's a documentary on Lego that's well worth checking out, actually. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that is the Lego store opening. I would definitely go down and check it out and buy some sets. If you've got kids, they've got a fantastic range of, you know, the Duplo and the other type of things for younger Lego fans. And they also sell other stuff that's not Lego, accessories, stuff to put your Lego in, figure holders. Yeah, I mean, anything Lego related. They're soon going to have cell phone covers as well, so you can put Lego onto the back of your cell phone, which I will totally do. I can totally see that being a thing.
Won't that make your phone very bulky?
Who cares? It's Lego, you know? If you can put some Lego figurines on it, I don't mind.
All right, enjoy. I will not be going to that store.
Come on, you know you want to go check out.
My pick this week is sticking with the photography theme. I've decided to take my photography more seriously. You know, I'm really one of those guys who bought a DSLR many years ago and basically doesn't know how to shoot much more than putting it into P mode and hitting the button. So I really want to understand what the A and the S and the M on my camera do as well, and to really start to learn how to program shutter speeds and all the rest of it, and to take proper photography, depth of field, take images of the night sky and all that sort of thing, and make photographs that are really good. So I've decided I'm going to invest the time to learn digital photography properly so that I can take great photographs.
Nice.
So I've came across this guy called Tony Northrup. I don't know if you've heard of him, Rehat. He's an American.
No.
He's an American professional photographer who's written a series of books, and he does tons of videos on YouTube about digital photography. And he's absolutely brilliant. You know, as I mentioned, I bought the Nikon D500, and he does a half-hour introduction to the camera. It was absolutely superb. He does it so well, and in a way that, you know, it isn't dumbed down. You have to watch the video several times to really pick up everything because it's so dense with information. But he does it in a way that that someone who's a relative amateur when it comes to photography can understand and start to get into and learn quickly. So I had a look at the guy's website. His wife Chelsea and him have produced a number of books. Video books, so they're e-books, and you can get a print version if you really want. But they send you a file that you can open up in the Kindle app on your iPad or open on your Amazon Kindle.
Nice.
I've started going through these. They're fantastic books, and they linked, as I said, to tons of video. You know, each book has about 12 or 14 hours of video that you can watch. So as you're going through the book, you click a button and watch a video associated with that chapter, where he goes through and explains exactly how it works with the camera and what you can do.
Nice.
So he's got a bundle on his website, which is currently on sale for $56. Works out to about, I guess, 750 rand or so. Of four books, which includes access to all the videos. So his most famous book is something called How to Create Stunning Digital Photography. That's the one of the books that comes in this bundle of four books. But also there are two books on Adobe products. So there's one on Lightroom Creative Cloud, specifically aimed at photographers. Obviously, Lightroom is a photographic product. And then he's done a book on Photoshop for photographers. And I've started going through that Photoshop book, and just in the first 10 pages, I've learned more about Photoshop than I've learned just fiddling around with the software myself over the last 10 years and nice. What you can do with it. It's unbelievable how powerful Photoshop is, and I've only just started to delve into this book.
Oh, yeah, Photoshop is beyond. It's one of my favorite applications of all time, without a doubt.
It's fantastic, and this book will... you know, even if you're a Photoshop pro, you're going to learn new stuff reading this book. And then the last book in the bundle is his guide to buying cameras, lenses, tripods, and flashes. I haven't looked at that book yet, but I've gone through some of the other books, and it's well worth $56 for hours. But I think it must be at least 40 or 50 hours of training videos here, plus a ton of reading material, which will, if, as he claims in the front of the book, take you to, from an amateur to a professional photographer once you've completed it all and mastered the subject in full. But I can highly recommend it. I haven't finished going through them yet, but the amount I've learned already just reading through the first few chapters of some of these books has justified the $56 price tag.
Nice. And Lightroom, I would also highly recommend. I mean, the first thing I would recommend anybody do is learn how to use a camera, then shoot RAW, and then use Lightroom. Because yep. with the RAW shooting in RAW and using Lightroom, you can do so many incredible things and really bring out so many beautiful colors in your photographs. And that's how the professionals do it.
Yeah.
And then also presets. Presets, I'm sure they'll cover it in the book, but presets is the tool to use. And you can buy a lot of great presets and then fiddle from there. It's just a great way to get hold of to get better at photography. I love it.
Yeah. Now, I've already started shooting in RAW, and I'm slowly learning my way around shutter speeds and aperture settings and ISO and all the rest of it. But my attempt at photographing the moon on Friday night during the lunar eclipse was a spectacular failure.
But listen, you should never feel ashamed to push it to P and just to get the shot out, eh?
Yeah. Yeah,
especially once you as you're learning. I mean, I only started shooting full manual, and I've been shooting since school days. So at school I shot manual, but since digital I only shot manual again probably 5 years ago. Up until then, for the last 15 years before that, it was just on P mode, because with digital you could do it and you could push it quite nicely.
Yeah, that's what I did with my old camera, was just use P mode, but I want to learn how to use all of the settings.
No, for sure. No, it's definitely better if you can do it, but sometimes you just need to get that shot.
Mm. Interestingly, in the introduction to Stunning Digital Photography, Tony Northrop writes that he shoots most of his photos in aperture priority mode, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, because that, I mean, allows him to really, because he's obviously focused on depth of field. So for him, it's more important to quickly set that than, and the camera is clever enough to know what shutter speed needs to use once you've set in your.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you know your camera controls, to be honest with you, and you know, once you know the result of a photograph you've shot, so you know what it looks like at this and these settings, switching them with those two controllers on your camera layout is pretty straightforward. Mm. So it can be done.
Yeah.
Just a bit of practice.
Yeah. Yeah, practice makes perfect. I think the more you play, the more you learn, and it's almost muscle memory that has to kick in after a while, right?
And that was one of the biggest things for me testing this Fujifilm camera. It took me a few days just to get my head around the new way of using it.
Yeah.
And that's probably the biggest thing that puts people off from using a new camera is, oh, I don't know how to use this. You just need to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
And these books are great. I'm going to check them out. Exactly.
Yeah, I can highly recommend them. Even if you're maybe not one of the world's top pro photographers, you probably won't learn anything from this. But I think anyone who's amateur or even an intermediate photographer or someone aspiring to be pro will learn something from these books. So I think that's almost our show, Rehat. Before we close out with your song pick this week, let's do our quiz. First question, which bank has said it will allow customers to trial Samsung Pay in South Africa ahead of its commercial launch, and that is Absa.
Second question, Intel shares fell sharply this week after it delayed the introduction of what? And the answer there is microprocessors using 10 nanometer technology. And they are catching up here. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, and they're struggling more and more to adhere to Moore's law, aren't they? It's getting more and more difficult the smaller and smaller they go. The shares of two social media companies took a battering this week over investor fears about their ability to continue growing user numbers. Who are they? And those companies are Facebook and Twitter.
Fourth question. Ultron this week concluded the sale of which legacy business? And the answer is PowerTech Transformers. And no, that is not the robots.
I didn't even think of that. and the last question in this week's quiz, what exciting discovery was made on Mars this week? And that's the answer there. A large liquid lake of water below the southern pole, which has scientists excited about the possibility that it may contain life.
We are living in such an exciting time. Man, I cannot wait to hear what they find underneath the atmosphere there.
I'm sure NASA is going to be sending up a probe in the next couple of years to dig under the ice and find out what's in that water. Can't wait.
Unless Elon gets there first.
Unless Elon gets there first. True.
That car already made a spin past there.
I think Elon's getting himself to all sorts of other trouble these days, by the looks of it. I think he needs to get himself off Twitter somehow. So last week we introduced a new feature on the show where we pick a song at the end of the show, just something that could be something new, could be something old, just something that's grabbed our attention this week. And I played a bit of Pineapple Thief for the inaugural event last week. And Rechot, you're going to select something this week. What have you got?
So the song I've got is by a beautiful band called the Fabulous Thunderbirds, a fusion of blues and rock and roll type of sound. And the song is called Powerful Stuff. And it's been around for a while. And it's just one of the songs that's from a young kid. It's just been one of my favorite rock tunes that I would start anything with. So I thought it was quite apt that for the first, this would be the pick.
Fantastic. So we'll play out on the show today with the Fabulous Thunderbirds. I love the name of that band. And
yeah.
And as always, if you've got any feedback before we get to the music, our WhatsApp number, if you don't know it by now, is 071-999-1111 and info@techcentral.co.za is our email address. And Christoph, Linda, thank you for your email this week. I meant to get to it during the show today, but we'll touch on it next week. You had some questions around set-top boxes for TVs. We'll talk about that in some more detail in our next show. But from Rechad and myself, until next week, enjoy the tunes and cheers.
Ciao, ciao.
Josh. Yeah.